studio. He's got many thoughts.
Yes.
He has many movies that are not the Avengers movie.
That's
has that broken all the records yet?
Not yet. It hasn't passed Avatar yet, but it will. In fact, I think worldwide it has. James Cameron sent out a congratulatory tweet showing the Avengers logo sinking the Titanic, which I thought was pretty good.
But it beat Titanic. That happened last week.
But right? Avatar is weirdly enough, because Avatar is the least remembered, least beloved blockbuster of all time. Everybody wanted to see it because of the great technology involved. And it was really cool to look at. Mm-hmm. Then everybody found out it was just dances with wolves with blue people.
She was like a monkey horsey blue person, right?
Yes, what
was
that? Tail.
Yeah, she had a tail. But she was kind of like, but it was weird because at the same time, still kind of hot.
Yes. And, they had the Sam Worthington played the guy who was paralyzed in real life, but then as his avatar could run around, and it looked really great. They just announced this week, he's making a million of these movies. The last Avatar movie will be in the 2030s. So we'll be dead.
Why are we?
I saw you post that. Why? They've only had, correct me if I'm wrong, one Avatar.
That's
so
correct.
Far. So there hasn't even been a sequel, but they were announcing like a whole messload of these movies.
And I don't know if people really want them anymore. I mean, the first one was interesting, but James Cameron decided, and that would be his entire career now, if he does just these Avatar movies. Yeah. I'd rather see him do different stuff. So you never know how that's going to go. But all that stuff, they've already spent millions of dollars on those sequels just in the development stages.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not in theaters now.
No.
Avengers Endgame is. People are still yelling at each other about it, about different timelines, and saying some people are saying the directors are stupid because they gave one theory about their own movie, and a lot of people are saying, no, that's not what happened in your movie. So that's fun. But the great thing is more movies are coming out. Avengers Endgame will be playing all summer long in your theaters, but we get new stuff every day, and the Rebel Wilson, she's the Australian comic. She was Fat Amy in the Pitch Perfect
movies.
That's what kind of made her a star to American audiences. And then Anne Hathaway, Academy Award winner.
Mm-hmm.
You guys might remember a movie called Dirty Rotten Scoundrels from the 80s. Steve Martin and Michael Caine.
Right.
It was a con man movie. Mm-hmm. And that was actually a remake of a movie that David Niven and Marlon Brando did way back in the day. This is now the 21st century female reboot of it. So Anne Hathaway plays a very sophisticated con artist, and Rebel Wilson plays the clunky, oafish bull in a china shop con artist who decide that they might have to team up, and they're in the south of France, and like start pulling off some cons. So here's Rebel Wilson and Anne Hathaway in a movie now called The Hustle.
What do men want?
Babes.
No.
Back door. Front door. Pegging. Oh my God, threesome. What is it? What's the answer?
They want to be heroes. There's nothing more compelling to a man than a vulnerable woman. Observe.
Oh, wow, you can just tear up like that.
You can just balance a tear right on that lower lid.
And can you make the tear roll down your cheek? Oh, oh. Okay, but can you make it go back up?
You can always tell if a movie's in desperate straits when the bouncy score almost drowns out the activities, because it keeps telling you, this is funny, this is funny. And that was Anne Hathaway. They're murdering a British accent. It seemed like she was playing a character on a Saturday Night Live skit, mm-hmm. and after about 3 minutes, she later has to do a German accent. It's disastrous.
If you'd like to hear murdering of accents, you just stay tuned.
Okay.
All right.
Okay. That's fantastic. So, the problem, a good con man movie or con woman movie, we should be kind of taken along for the con and surprised. The Usual Suspects some of the David Mamet movies. The Sting is the classic example, Ro, because we did not know what the Sting was. We thought we did. And then it got us in one of the great surprise endings of all time. David Mamet movies like House of Games, where you're not sure who's conning who. Here, it's just a series of these women conning incredibly stupid men by spinning incredibly dopey stories that nobody would fall for ever. So there's no subtlety to it, no slickness to it. Anne Hathaway and Rebel Wilson, whatever is the lack of chemistry, you know, people always talk about the chemistry between stars. They have no chemistry. They would have flunked high school chemistry.
Rebel Wilson is
funny, but she's been doing the same shtick for like 20, 15 years now. She plays the, you know, the plus size gal who makes fun of her own size, does a lot of twerking, does a lot of falling down, does a lot of bumping into things. And then Anne Hathaway is playing the vixen, and she later does a German accent that's even worse than the British accent. So the con is on anyone who plunks down $10 to see this movie.
It's
90 minutes, and I felt like it was 3 hours long.
You'll never get it back.
It's so bad. And it's one of those movies, 5 minutes into it, you go, this is not good. This is bad. And you'd be right. One star.
That's a shot.
One star usually puts you on the worst of the year list. Most of the movies on the worst of the year list are one star, maybe one and a half at most. It's so bad.
You ever give a half star?
You know, I don't, because it's too confusing when people say, well, what's a half a star?
Right.
I think you're doing some sort of...
Or a star and a half when you see it in print.
I'll do a star and a half because you can see it. But if you see a half a star, it just looks weird. So last week we had The Intruder, which was 0 stars because it was ugly. But I would say between the two, at least The Intruder, you can yell at the people on the screen because they're so stupid.
Okay, so this is May.
Yes.
Even though it doesn't exactly seem like it. But I'm told on the calendar
it's almost summer. It's the summer movie season.
Right, it is. This is where, as you pointed out, the blockbuster season actually started in March this year.
Yeah.
But this is an important month. This is where a lot of the commerce begins and the run-ups. Why is there Drek heading the theaters? Is it because it's not yet Memorial Day?
Yeah, they're counter-programming Endgame because they know Endgame is going to be the number one movie probably 3 or 4 weeks in a row. So last week we had Long Shot with Seth Rogen and Charlize Theron, which I thought was a funny comedy. So you get these kind of, you know, mostly R-rated PG-13 comedies, you know, smaller films, one of them hoping to hit a quick $20, $25 million opening.
And another piece of business here that I'm interested in, you know, you've had these quick-to-Netflix movies where they come out for a week in the theater, and then they're on Netflix or whatever. And they were doing that in the winter into the spring. Is that a weather play? Because they know people are not going to go out to the theaters. And there'll be fewer of those in the summer?
There will be fewer of those, but there still are some. But you'll see more that are actually playing in the theaters. But funny you should mention that. The next movie we're going to talk about is exactly a Netflix and chill movie, although since it's wine country, I call it a Netflix and spill film, the first one.
Not on the white couch.
Oh, my God.
So, Wine Country.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this I find interesting. Amy Poehler directed it. It's her first time directing a film. She's directed TV episodes and stars. And it has Maya Rudolph, Rachel Dratch, Anna Gasteyer, a couple of writers from SNL who are also performers, Tina Fey. All of whom in real life get together once a year or so and have reunions and drink wine. And this is a fictional version of that. And what I love about this is in this movie, so they're celebrating Rachel Dratch's 50th birthday. They're all spread around the country. They plan a getaway weekend in a beautiful, you know, Airbnb in Napa Valley. The conceit in this movie is they were all waitresses at a Chicago pizza parlor in the 90s, early 90s. And that's how they're all getting together. This is a nod to the fact that they were all at Second City in the early 90s. So it's kind of a neat little touch on
some
that.
Some of them were working in pizza, as it
and
turns out.
And working as waitresses in a cocktail bar when I met you.
As it turns out, Rachel Dratch was the receptionist in my daughter's pediatrician.
See that?
Oh, wow.
Office. And I just found that out because apparently Stephen Colbert also, when he lived here, used the same pediatrician for his child. And they told the story on Colbert. I remember you from being the receptionist.
Isn't that something? Yeah, because of course none of them were making, they were taking classes and studying and doing programs at Second City, which meant you have to work during the day or after your shift. So they all took different types of jobs, and it was kind of one of the many golden eras for Second City. In fact, at one point, Colbert was Steve Carell's understudy on the main troupe. That's the kind of level of talent. Tina Fey was here, lived here for 3 or 4 years, all of them. So the movie is five women, female friends who get together for a getaway weekend in wine country. One of the things I love about this film is they drink a lot of wine, but they have no patience or use for these pretentious sommeliers at these wine tasting places who try to tell them about the different notes of the Cabernet.
And one of them finally goes,
I detect the note of grape. Can we drink now? So they just want to drink and have fun. And they're all really, really good at playing drunk. There's a lot of moments where they're doing a lot of, you know, they sing along to all those 1990s anthems like I Would Die for You by Prince, Eternal Flames, Susanna Hoffs. And you know what's going to happen. they're going to be happy to see each other. One of them's going to have a crisis she hasn't told the other ones about. There are going to be some confrontations, and they're all going to end up being buddies as they were at the beginning of the weekend. But it is actually the perfect movie to sit at home and watch wine, or watch, drink wine, watch Wine Country. And it looks beautiful. They clearly filmed all of it in Napa County. And had a great time doing it. Looks like the kind of movie where they had as much fun making it as we're having watching it. But just watching all of them, clearly in some scenes, just going with it, is fantastic.
Well, they're such talented actors. I mean, think about that. That's quite a group.
The group. It's a Mount Rushmore
of
comedians. Here's a little taste of Wine Country.
It's an amazing day in Wine Country.
When was the last time we were all together?
I just want this to feel like a regular vacation. And somewhere in there, I'll just slide into 50. To Rebecca!
Age is just a number.
What would you say your soul's age is?
18. Old enough to drink and bone. Don't have my own car yet.
One of my favorite scenes, too, is they go to an art show that a waitress named Jade, who's like 23, is having her first art show. And there's like six women who are 50 and about six women who are 22, kind of in a face-off at the art gallery showing. But the older women kept saying, why do we resent you? Because you're just everything we wanted you to be. You're self-confident, and you're celebrating your diversity, and there's one, you know, you're gender fluid. Uh-huh. And yet we still hate you, we have to say. You shouldn't be this confident this early on. And it's just great because it's like, they keep saying, we're not going to be like men. We're not going to turn on each other. We're not going to be the stereotypes of women who, you know, resent the new and up-and-coming generation, but we're also human beings.
Does it take them through the arc of their friendship?
No, it's all about the weekend. I mean, we see some flashback things, but it's all about their getaway weekend. And celebrating with the one character turning 50 who keeps saying,
so the writing, the writing is good. Who wrote this?
The two former SNL
writers. Okay.
One of them is Paul Spivey, I believe. They're also in it and unbelievably funny. One of the characters is a plus size, newly single lesbian, and she meets Jade, the waitress, the young one, and she tells her, I live in Portland and I have a vintage store. And the waitress goes, you're just like the coolest person ever. And she goes, oh, you should come to Portland. There's a bunch of me up there. You know, just really smart little stuff like that. Three solid stars for Wine Country. Three generous pours, we should say.
Oh, you like it. All right.
Okay.
And like you said, it's an all-star cast.
It's just fun watching them interact with
just
each other.
Together.
And knowing their off-camera history and the comfort of... And Maya Rudolph, God, is she
good. I love
her. What a treasure. She's maybe the best performance in the film.
All right, now, there's the Muhammad Ali two-night miniseries doc.
Yes, I can't wait to tell you guys about this. So, Antoine Fuqua, who directed Training Day and the Equalizer movies, directs a two-part, it's 165-minute documentary about Muhammad Ali. It's called What's My Name because Muhammad Ali, Cassius Clay changed his name when he was just 22, but he didn't go public with it until a few years later, and some of the fighters who were going up against him wouldn't call him Muhammad Ali. One of them was Ernie Terrell, who was an old school African-American boxer. And Ali, who could be cruel at times, in addition to all his charms and all his legendary contributions, beat him senseless in the fight, but wouldn't let him go down and kept chanting at him, what's my name? What's my name? Because he wouldn't call him Muhammad Ali. So this is where this comes from. This documentary is unbelievable. One of the cool things is there's all this archival footage. A lot of it I haven't seen before. There's no talking heads. The documentary is narrated by Muhammad Ali from the grave, because think of Muhammad Ali in the 60s and 70s. Probably was on talk shows more than any figure in the world, right?
True.
And certainly was filmed everywhere he went. So so you hear in his own words his own life. Because everywhere he went, and he was always smart to do this, he always had cameras rolling, too. So, for example, there was a point where he went, he created a country compound in Pennsylvania to train, because he felt he was getting too soft being in New York or Los Angeles. Deer Park, I think it was called. All cabins, fresh running water, growing vegetables. And he talks all about how it's great to breathe fresh air, drink unfiltered water, eat natural foods. This is him in 1967, way before anybody thought. And chopping trees in the woods as his training, getting his head back together. And it gets into all of that. Obviously, there's a lot about the 3 years he spent on the sidelines because he wouldn't go to the Vietnam War, refused to fight. You know, he always had that, famous argument. You're sending a bunch of black boys, black men, to fight a white man's war against the Viet Cong who've never done anything to me. You know, and he eventually won that case. And then the film footage of the fights is amazing because They have the luxury. It's two parts. It's going to be on HBO starting, I think, next Tuesday. They have the luxury to let you see. You know, a lot of these documentaries, you get like 15 seconds of the fight. You get like a round and a half of him and Frazier at the Garden. Or, you know, 10 or 15 minutes of him fighting George Foreman. You know, in the famous one, you know, one of the greatest upsets. He was an 8-1 underdog. And, of course, you get a lot of him talking about society and race. He has this one great monologue where he talks about, he says to his mother, he says, like, because he was raised a Christian, and he says, Mama, like, where were all the white people at the Last Supper? Were they in the kitchen making the eggs and milk and honey? You know, he goes, how come there's no pictures of no black people? When we go to heaven, are we going to be in the kitchen? And he talks about how, you know, devil's food cake is black, angel cake is white. It's like almost like a George Carlin routine, but he's saying this in 1965. Why is it black male? Why is it a black cat? Why is everything black negative?
Mm-hmm.
So brilliant stuff. I don't know. Do we have a clip of this? I know the guys were looking for something.
Yeah,
we do. Anybody who's doing the right thing, they catch a lot of hell. You cannot please God and the devil too. When I'm rejected here and rejected there, then I have a good feeling spiritually because I'm right. If I wasn't right, then they would accept me.
Wow. Wow. That is and it's really, in a lot of ways, that is his coda, right? I mean, that's his thing. He that's what makes him, I think, the greatest American athlete of all times. Because it's not just about his incredible athleticism and all the things that he did, you know, whether it was the, you know, Olympic gold medal all the way through, you know, his many, many titles, but his the fact that, you know, he stood there and he became a beloved figure by being a controversial figure.
Yes.
You know, and he went, and people, it was a different, I suppose it would be a very different moment now with social media. But even his greatest detractors couldn't take away his incredible skill.
Yeah, I still think he was the greatest heavyweight boxer of all time. He ended up with five or six losses, but three of them were when he was 38, 39, 40 years old.
Right.
There's a real poignant moment. Larry Holmes, who was a great champion in his own right, knocked out Ali. Muhammad Ali was 39 years old, and you could actually hear in the film the beginning of the Parkinson's at that point already.
Wow.
And Larry Holmes is weeping after the fight because he so idolized Muhammad Ali. He had been a sparring partner, and he said, "You know." And there's, of course, the ubiquitous Howard Cosell and others saying, "You know, why are you crying? Ali's not crying." And he's like, "Because I want people to remember what a great man and great fighter he was, and it broke my heart to even fight him and have to beat him." So there was such affectionate, you know, affection and admiration. And he's also, of course, he's hilarious throughout. And there's, you know, him with Dick Cavett sparring on TV back in the day. And then Howard Cosell, of course, all those great exchanges.
That was the thing, too, is that you didn't see proud black men on television showing off their reveling in their blackness.
Yes.
It just didn't happen on network television in the 1960s, right? If their black character was on television, you know, and it was the beginning, right, you know, of black characters.
Yeah.
But these were all people who, so in many cases, were the second or third or fourth character on the show. Here was a guy who was in reality, right? He was on talk shows, and he was on, and wherever he was, he became the center of it, and he stood up, and it changed everything. And if people want to say, well, you know, that blank, you know, that so-and-so, I would take him out. You couldn't, right?
Yeah.
Because he was intellectually and physically superior to anybody who would ever encounter him.
Yeah, and that's the thing. He would, you know, he'd go on television with Gore Vidal or Norman Mailer, and they'd walk away saying,
"What do we do?"
Wow, you know, and they were, you know, Mailer in particular was a big fan, but, and then just, you know, he was a leading man, as Rose said. He was, you know, he was insanely good looking and charming, and, you know, listen, knew how to work a room, but he worked rooms across the globe. That was the thing. You know, Jackie Robinson was a great pioneer and a seminal figure. Muhammad Ali was a worldwide figure. So you see him meeting with Nelson Mandela. You see when he goes to England and they treat him like a god. And when he's in Africa and they really treat him like a god. It was worldwide. He was clearly the most famous person in the world. The Pope Even sad.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Well, I'm not as famous as Muhammad Ali.
Right.
And yet, you know, he had his beliefs. They're controversial. What I always remind people, too, about him, you know, people say, oh, he dodged the word, you know. Muhammad Ali was never going to be put in the front lines of the war in Vietnam. Clearly, if he had agreed to be drafted, he would have been fighting exhibitions and doing goodwill public relations.
And
he could have just done that, but he stood to his principles.
And he was right about the war. That was the thing. He ended up being right about it. All right.
Yeah.
So how many stars?
4 stars.
Ooh.
For What's My Name. If you know everything about Muhammad Ali, you'll still love it. If you need to learn about him and you're younger, you don't know, this is where you should start.
All right.
Awesome.
All right.
All right.